welcome to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Sarah Martin in Adelaide, and today on The Wire.
People with disability in Australia, no matter what kind of disability they have or how they acquired that disability or what treatments are available for that disability, need to have access to the supports that they need to be able to live an ordinary and equal life.
Queries have arisen as people have been knocked back from aspects of the NDIS for refusing some treatments. And
we really are living in a time where we have the de-pluralism of our political system. We tend to label individuals as you're a right-winger or you're a left-winger, and because of that we cannot converse.
Antisocial media. We begin our series looking at extremism in the online world. Also today, we talk voice, treaty and truth on NAIDOC Week. And how common is tribal violence in PNG? Stay tuned for these stories and more in the next half hour. In the 15th of March this year, Brenton Tarrant entered two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, armed with several high-powered firearms and killed 51 worshippers. Social media played a notable role in Tarrant's attack. He used Facebook Live to livestream the massacre and published a manifesto on Twitter and 8chan. In his manifesto and during the attack, Tarrant referenced internet memes, online video games, and even a famous YouTuber. In the first episode of Antisocial Media, Extremism in the Online World, an original four-part series for The Wire, Ben D'Andrea explores the different ways in which extremists use social media to push their agendas.
The key thing for the
attacks in March this year, governments and social media companies across the world have agreed to take action against online extremism. But what exactly is meant by online extremism, and why does social media play such an important role? Dr. Isaac Fear, Director of the National Security Program at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, describes the history of this problem.
You always had individuals who challenged mainstream views, and they were called radicals. It's only really in the last, I would say, two or three generations that we began to see radicals as extremists. And the challenge that we have is that nowadays these radicals bringing a violent component to their assessment. Radical change to society, not through the ballot box, but through the usage of violence.
How do you think social media has contributed at all to that development?
It used to be that ideas would be transmitted through either letters or news. And once literacy became much more common, it became easier to spread the ideas. Now, social media effectively serves nowadays as it allows individuals that might hold violent extremist views to reach out much more quickly to other individuals who share the same views. And by doing so, they are able to magnify their ideas. So nowadays, if we're looking at the 2019 situation, we really are living in a time where we have the de-pluralism of our political system. We tend to label individuals as you're a right-winger or you're a left-winger, and because of that, we cannot converse. And that then seems to encourage the belief that the only way to bring about change is through extremist violent acts.
Dr. Isaac Fear, Director of the National Security Program at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Professor Greg Barton of Deakin University says social media is used as an outlet to push various extreme agendas.
They all use similar dynamics, but there are distinct differences between some of the older extremist groups, including the ones we associate with radical Islamist terrorism and right-wing extremist groups. Right-wing extremist groups have been around, of course, for a very long time, even longer than religious extremist groups of the Al-Qaeda Islamic State variety. But the way that right-wing extremism manifests itself in the online space today has some characteristic differences in terms of style. So it's, right-wing extremism tends to be much more about so-called shitposting, much more ostensibly ironic and playful and ambiguous whereas other forms of extremism, including that associated with Al-Qaeda or Islamic State, tend to be more straightforward in terms of arguing a case for being the freedom fighters. Right-wing extremists have those elements, it's true, but the presentation is a much more playful and often difficult to nail down form. The ambiguity is a key part of the playful defence. And so that makes the process of forming a camaraderie and friendship and getting recognition even more powerful than in other more direct forms of extremism, because it allows somebody to be lulled into a sense that it's just part of a playful game and that nothing serious is happening. And then by the time they have any awareness of how serious the ideas are, they lack the objectivity to be alarmed and find their way out.
Greg Barton, Professor of Global Islamic Politics at Deakin University. Ending that report by The Wire's Ben D'Andrea. And tune in next Thursday for the second part in our series. At least 18 women and children have been killed as a result of tribal massacre in Papua New Guinea's highlands on Monday morning. While the cause is currently unknown, it is speculated that the attack on the village of Karita was a form of retribution for a recent tribal dispute. The Wire's Georgina McKay spoke to Ahmed Halak, head of mission in PNG for the International Committee of the Red Cross, about tribal tensions in the area and what can be done.
Unfortunately, tribal fighting is quite a constant feature of the highlands. I have to say, this recent incident or series of incidents in Hala, where reportedly up to 26 women and children, some of them pregnant, were killed, is really quite horrific. And it's probably the worst mass event of so many innocent civilians being killed in one or a handful of incidents that we've seen, I think, since we opened our office in the highlands in 2012.
This massacre is said to be the cause of some tribal tensions. What's the history like between the tribes in that area?
We're still trying to understand what exactly happened. At the moment, all of our information is secondhand. But what we've normally seen during our time in the highlands is that there are a lot of tensions between different tribes in different areas, which are historical, where there are genuine grievances going back many years. Some of them are more recent, but they tend to be quite complex. They are linked to anything from substance abuse within the communities, disputes over land, disputes over property. There's also a lot of election-related violence when elections are indeed taking place. I mean, these are quite complex issues, and it's always really hard to understand exactly what's at play.
Do you think this is a rare occurrence, or are tribal massacres prevalent in PNG?
Tribal fighting is prevalent, especially in the highlands, and unfortunately, the killing of civilians not directly participating in the fighting is also all too frequent.
Do you think the recent influx of high-powered weapons is partly to blame for this?
If you look at any of the literature covering society and the development in the PNG Highlands over the last 30 years or so, I mean, it's generally widely agreed that the availability of modern weapons in these areas over the last 30 years or so has led to a huge increase in the humanitarian consequences of this tribal fighting. In the past, bows and arrows and spears would have been used, and generally the people directly involved in the fighting would be the ones who would get killed or injured. With the availability of modern weapons, we're seeing civilians targeted and killed, homes being destroyed, clinics and schools being destroyed as well. So the humanitarian consequences are definitely much more similar now to what you would expect in a full-blown conflict in Afghanistan or Syria or other conflicts that sort of dominate the news.
Do you think those responsible will be held accountable, or is there just not enough resources to be able to do that?
Yeah, unfortunately, the people behind such attacks are rarely, if ever, held accountable. And I think that's probably one of the main issues that needs to be tackled. People need to be held accountable for their actions, and facilities like schools and clinics are destroyed and targeted.
What do you think needs to be done in order to prevent any further tribal violence?
Our focus right now is to assist people who've been directly affected by this by providing them with material assistance once we've done an assessment of the humanitarian consequences. And at all times, we are engaged in a constant dialogue with all parties involved in such fighting, as well as the local leaders and the national authorities on how to avoid civilians being targeted in such attacks, how to preserve access to basic services and the integrity of basic services.
Ahmed Halak, head of mission in PNG for the International Committee of the Red Cross, speaking there to The Wire's Georgina McKay.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with The Wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
Last month, the Administrative Appeals Tribunal deliberated on a case involving a young man with cerebral palsy and severe dysphagia who was appealing the National Disability Insurance Agency's decision not to fund his fluid thickeners and nutritional support products. It ruled that it was reasonable and necessary for the NDIS to fund these products when prescribed by an accredited practicing dietitian. Meanwhile, other claimants have been denied access to the NDIS because they declined invasive surgery or psychiatric drugs. The Wire's Jared McLaughlin investigates the rights of NDIS recipients, starting with asking Elle Gibbs, Director of Communications and Media at People with Disability Australia, about the underlying problems this could raise.
The key thing for the NDIA is that people with disability in Australia, no matter what kind of disability they have or how they acquired that disability or what treatments are available for that disability, need to have access to the supports that they need to be able to live an ordinary and equal life. That's kind of the point of the NDIS, that it was meant to be a system where there was universal national access to support for people with disability who needed that support. And that's the key question for the NDIA. Do people with disability need the support? Not is there some possible treatment maybe that might work somewhere over there, and then the NDIA using that to deny people access to the scheme.
Elle Gibbs, Director of Communications and Media at People with Disability Australia. Evie Naffrell from Disability Services Consulting says it's important to understand criteria for receiving support through the NDIS, but it is not without complexity.
To become an NDIS participant, which means to get any money or make any claims, you have to have a permanent and significant disability. And so the NDIS will say your disability is not permanent if you haven't explored all options for treatment. So if somebody hasn't tried a certain medication, or even if it's dangerous or it's not recommended for them, or if they haven't tried a certain surgery, if they can't afford it or it's too risky, the NDIS will still say you haven't exhausted all of your options, so we're not going to give you any funding. I think the NDIS is violating people's right to make an informed choice about their own health. I think when people have to make the decision between a potentially life-threatening surgery or taking medications or treatments that are not evidence-based and receiving support from the NDIS, that's an impossible situation to put people in, and I think it's not right at all.
Do you feel that it's right to restrict or to prohibit a certain group of people from wanting to access funding in the NDIS to be able to acquire services or support products that they may not be able to get from the public health system?
The NDIS doesn't fund things that are the health department's responsibility, but I don't think it's right that people should not be able to access supports from the NDIS to live a normal life because they can't afford to access supports from the health system, whether that's surgery or other treatments. I think there should be something that supports people to access what they need to get their diagnoses and their evidence so that they can receive the support they need from the NDIS.
Do you feel that the NDIS really needs to do more in terms of trying to articulate what it is that a client who's on the plan can or cannot access?
I think the NDIS has a lot of work to support NDIS participants to understand how they can spend their plans. About 67% of funding that goes into an NDIS is spent. And when you look at Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, 1 in 10 people don't spend a single dollar from their plan. So there is a lot of work to be done to support people to understand how they can spend their funding.
And what about those within other minorities, including those who have intellectual disabilities or developmental disabilities?
We don't know about the underspend figures for groups other than Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders. That's the only group that the NDIA picks out in their data. But I would say that it's a pretty common problem across most of the NDIS, that there are not enough providers for people to buy supports from, that they don't understand how to spend their plans, that people just require a bit of support in connecting with providers and they're not really getting it.
Evie Naffrell from Disability Services Consulting. Elle Gibbs says People with Disability Australia are strongly advocating for improvements to the NDIS and to the NDIA.
In the federal election that's just gone, we had a range of ideas for the NDIA in terms of providing a more equal access to the scheme. So we know that, for example, women, people with intellectual disability, people who live in regional and remote areas of Australia don't have the same levels of access to the NDIS as other people. So we have certainly raised those issues with the NDIA. We think that one of the key things that they can do, or the government can do, is to lift the staffing cap on the NDIS so that the NDIA can actually employ as many people as they need to get the job done. So we see that as a key area that needs improvement and needs to change. Recent decisions of the AAT, for example, the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, that do look at where that divide is between disability and health. So that the NDIS, for example, will now provide supports for people who need help with swallowing and some of those quite specific issues around that so-called divide between disability and health.
Elle Gibbs, Director of Communications and Media at People with Disability Australia, ending that report by The Wire's Jared McLaughlin. NAIDOC Week celebrations are being held across Australia to celebrate history, culture and achievements of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. It's an opportunity for everyone to get involved. John Paul Jenke is the co-chair of NAIDOC Week. I spoke to him about the significance of this year's theme, Voice, Treaty, Truth.
For generations, Aboriginal people have been saying, you know, we want to say in the policies and the programs and the things that affect us. So we want a voice. We also want to finish some of the unfinished business that this country has carried for, you know, almost 250 years, and that is a treaty with its First Nations people. And we believe that to get to a treaty, we actually need to have a bit of truth-telling. We need to tell the true history of this country. So those three initiatives have been going for generations. The committee felt that, you know, this year is the second year anniversary of the Uluru Statement to the Heart. So those three key factors, voice, treaty, truth, are actually the three key main factors of structural reform that was identified at the convention at Uluru 2 years ago. And they are the three main factors of the Uluru Statement from the Heart. So we wanted to build on that momentum. I think importantly, we see NAIDOC Week not as something to solve in 7 days, but actually to start that national conversations.
Is it heartening that now our Indigenous Affairs Minister at a federal level and Shadow Indigenous Affairs Minister are both First Nations people?
It's history in the making. We had the National NAIDOC Awards last Saturday in Canberra, and that's an awards where we recognise and honour 10 outstanding achievers across many sectors and disciplines. Importantly, we had the Minister Ken Wyatt and the Shadow Minister, Linda Burney, walk out on stage together to present an award, coming out and showing sort of bipartisanship, but also probably showing that they are prepared to work with each other. And I think that's important. We know that there's going to be political differences between those two, but I think importantly they both want to see some sort of advancement and progress in Indigenous affairs over the next couple of years. So we really hope that there's a re-engagement with Aboriginal communities, and we feel that they are two perfect individuals to drive that change.
Ken Wyatt's come out this week talking about trying to achieve a referendum on constitutional recognition within the next 3 years. It's got a bit of kickback from within his party, but part of what he was outlining was very much a need to be consultative, to have these conversations and move forward. How do you feel about his chances of getting that across the line?
I'm heartened to see his energy for constitutional change and reform. I'm also heartened to see that he knows it's not going to be an easy path. And one of the things he said yesterday, he's got so many key stakeholders from both sides of the debate that he will need to find common ground with. And I think a lot of Indigenous Australians and a lot of people go, we need to actually finish this unfinished business that we've been carrying for 250 years. We need to heal this and heal the country and move forward. But he said he's prepared to talk to everyone, engage everyone. In particular, he said that the path ahead needs to be co-designed with Aboriginal people, and I think that's a positive step forward.
In terms of telling truth, and what we've heard in recent years is conversations about the true history, about frontier wars, about pre-colonial agricultural farming and scientific knowledge, all of these things are being raised more to the mainstream. Do you feel like there's enough of that infiltrating curriculum in terms of schools?
I think so, yes. And I think there's a greater appetite in the education system for Indigenous history. And I say that looking back to two decades ago when I finished school. You know, we learnt nothing about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander history. In fact, the only thing I learnt at school was we read the chant of Jimmy Blacksmith. I learnt more about Egyptian culture, about the Middle East, Native American culture than I did about the oldest living continuing culture on the planet, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander history. And that's the history of this country. So I see, you know, the education system doing a lot more with engaging with Indigenous history, Indigenous culture and Indigenous diversity at all levels, so from preschools all the way up to universities. But I also see them learning things that probably were taught differently back in my generation. So in my generation, we were taught that Aboriginal people were noble savages, that this land was terra nullius, that this land belonged to no one. Today, I think we're learning that, you know, Aboriginal people were our first engineers, our first bakers, our first astronomers, as navigators. There were hundreds of Aboriginal nations in this country when Captain Cook arrived in 1770. I always say, look, the 65,000-year history of this country is actually the history for all of us. It's all our history, and it's our nation's history. And well, I think all Australians should be proud that this country has the oldest continuing culture on the planet. We should all celebrate that Australia has that as part of its history.
John Paul Jenke, the co-chair of NAIDOC Week. Australia's first Indigenous firefighter team was formed in Sydney last week under the Fire and Rescue New South Wales IFARES program. The all-Aboriginal platoon has already made an impact on the community by acting as a positive role model for Indigenous children, breaking down barriers associated with people in uniforms and being a model of diversity. Craig Aldridge is the Aboriginal Inclusion and Diversity Officer at Fire and Rescue New South Wales. He told The Wire's Heloise Weiss about the program and how it was created.
It was a response to a public event where some Aboriginal community members actually said that they struggled with the recruitment process for the general recruitment of firefighters. Then the firefighters that were involved in that day actually took a step back and said, how can we develop a program that will increase Aboriginal employment through the Fire Brigade, as well as give people a good understanding of what the Fire Brigade is about.
What's the influence of the first all-Aboriginal fire and rescue platoon been like in the community?
Aboriginal people can make fantastic firefighters, and it gives our organisation the ability to reach into Aboriginal communities to develop strong relationships and deliver messages around home fire safety and being safe around fires and to be able to protect your family and protect your property.
What does the recruitment process look like at this stage for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people?
We've had about 80 to 90 people complete the program, and about 60 people have gone on to become firefighters. Five of those will be with the ACT Fire Service. We try to keep it exactly the same, so there's that level of integrity, so no one can say to us, you know, you got into the Fire Brigade because you're Aboriginal and things like that, where sometimes that's stereotyped across different places. Through the IFARES program, every participant gets the opportunity to complete a certificate for in fitness. This is something that is not done in the general recruitment. It covers the educational requirement when they do undertake the general recruitment process. Plus, it also enables people to then become gym instructors and work within the fitness industry.
A separate independent career pathway for Aboriginal people in the Fire and Rescue Department, is that more of an economic imperative or is it a broader attempt to reinstate cultural heritage?
It provides Aboriginal people with an opportunity to experience what it is to become a firefighter. With the increase of Aboriginal people coming into the Fire and Rescue in New South Wales, it does open up doors around culture and inclusion. It is an avenue to develop an understanding of what it is to become a recruit firefighter. We actually have our 2019 IFARES class graduating tomorrow night from the program, and then they'll undergo the general recruitment process in August as part of the program, and with any luck, many of them will then become firefighters in the new year.
Craig Aldridge, Aboriginal Inclusion and Diversity Officer at Fire and Rescue New South Wales, speaking to The Wire's Heloise Bias. And that's all we've got time for today. We'll be back again tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio Adelaide, and I'm Sarah Martin. Thanks for your company.